Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Liza Daly. She's the president of Three Press Consulting, based in Somerville, Massachusetts, and someone I think is probably more knowledgeable and expert on digital publishing than anyone I know. Hi, Liza. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
The reason that I said what I just said about you is that every single time I ask my network of people that I know who could answer this question, and it's usually some question that's beyond the scope of my understanding about how things work in digital publishing, almost every time people say, oh, you just ask Liza, she'll know. So, I think you are recognized, at least in digital publishing circles, as someone who's really smart. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what Three Press does, but also what your background is and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, my original background was not in publishing at all. In fact, I'm quite new to publishing in general. My first jobs were strict web development. This was back in the mid-90s when that was a very new thing that one could do for a living. So over the years, I've alternated between being a software developer working in the web or being a project manager working on web projects. And it was essentially an accident that I got involved in publishing when the company that I used to work for, which was a general web development firm, they're called iFactory, they're still around, they ended up specializing in doing pretty large-scale XML-based publishing platforms, mostly for the academic and university press market. And I was a software engineer on those projects. And these are fairly large dictionary and encyclopedia-type projects, lots of data, really very different from trade publishing, but it got me interested in publishing as a vector for doing web-related work. So when I decided to start my own company, it was much easier to focus on ebooks, which were then just emerging, at least they were emerging again in the commercial publishing world. And generally, everything I've tried to do in Three Press and my other projects has always been calling back to my foundation in the web. And fortunately for me, the trend in digital publishing has generally been to track with the web or just evolve new projects that are very tightly integrated with the web.
So, and that's actually a good point for me to ask a question, because I think this is really a key kind of, to use your word, I think vector is a really good word for this, that for a lot of people coming, and I'll say trade publishing is my background, but I think this applies to scholarly, academic, and professional publishing as well, people who are thinking about books as objects have converted that thinking from print to e-publishing. So we have the first evolution, in a sense, of digital publishing is to create e-books that literally, in some regard, look like print books. They're containers. They work on a reader, but you're still replicating the reading experience in a digital form. And we're coming now to a conversation about the web where, and I see this in a piece of work that you've done called IBIS Reader, which is essentially a web version of a reader that does not require you to have a device or a download any software. It's a different conceptualization of how one would read and consume, and kind of takes us away from the ebook as object. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you came to that understanding or what you think that will lead to as we go forward.
Sure. So IBIS and their similar projects are a little bit transitional. As you said, we've started out in this new renaissance of ebooks with a very book-like model of a contained file that has the content that's presented in a paginated way, and the idea is that you purchase this object that you can move around like you might move around a physical book. Then more recently, we've seen the emergence of cloud-based distribution systems, where cloud really just means that it's some server on the web, but that may still move a physical file around. And IBIS, to some extent, follows that trend, where there's a server up in the web, but users have upload or acquire these bundles of content, and then they can move them on different devices that are web-connected, or they can take that physical file away and put it on a hardware e-reader if they want. And that's a similar model to the way that the Kindle ecosystem works and the Kobo ecosystem. But I think we're going to start to see that idea of even the file, the EPUB as a singular object, probably morph again into something less contained. And although I won't be there, unfortunately, I know this is going to be a big topic of discussion at the Internet Archives Books in Browsers event, which is happening next week. A lot of different people are going to be talking about their ideas of what happens when we move away from just the container. But I think in trade publishing and the sort of consumer-level publishing, that container idea will persist for some time, or you know, perhaps indefinitely, because it is such a good analog to the printed book. But I'm particularly interested to see if there are going to be possibilities to monetize a more distributed idea of what a book is, a less contained one.
So yeah, because I think it's probably true that at least for the foreseeable future, we can have multiple ways for people to interact with books, and the book as object, even if it's print, will still persist. The book as object in digital form persists, as you say. But of course, there are some people who feel really strongly that the cloud type of information sharing and publishing has a lot of advantages that for some people will be very powerful, and as a paradigm, you know, enables a different way of looking at the object. But I think you're right. They probably continue together for a period of time. Now, when you talk about monetizing it, that also, of course, raises the question, do you have an alternative view of how you think the, let's say, the reader and the writer come together in this cloud? Is it a different model, you know, where maybe I pay you a subscription fee and all of your content is available to me, or is it that I am still going to buy access to a particular object one by one, or maybe both?
I think the subscription model, whether you're subscribed to an author or an imprint, or every title published in your language ever, that to me seems like the only logical progression to where we are today. We're seeing that kind of model really take hold in television and movies with services like Netflix, which is moving away from a container, a DVD model, to a pure cloud-based model. And when you stop needing to actually acquire an object, then the interference required to get access to that object essentially disappears. There's no particular reason why I shouldn't simply be able to acquire any book at any time, read it, and move on without necessarily having to make a purchase for a particular object and get it. The challenge is going to be how do people get paid? And I think there is going to come a time when the idea of buying a book, a digital book, will simply be, it's some fractional transaction of buying access to a huge pool of content.
Well, and here's a question. I mean, I sort of think of this in the context of the notion of book as part of a communal experience or part of an interactive experience between reader and writer. And we have a long history of a kind of authority model where a canon of literature is presented. Here's a book. You go buy it. You read it. There's really no way for you to respond directly back to the writer, even back to the publisher, back to the world. Now, with the web, of course, we're in a completely different environment where people are very well used to communicating with each other all the time about everything. So one of the questions I have about it, and we'll take IBIS as an example. I think that it's a good one. If we imagine the reader essentially being available, or the information and it's the reader device that enables me to read it is available to me anytime, anywhere, on any device, does it also then, or do you see it as enabling this multiplicity of communication between readers and writers, or readers and each other and writers? Does this new platform empower a different form of conversation about the information itself?
I think there's the potential for that, but what is holding some of that back, and this is not all bad by any means, are issues around intellectual property protection and privacy. So in IBIS and earlier projects I've worked on that were web-based readers, I've always taken a fairly conservative approach about all of the content that users have in their personal libraries is private. There's no way to share that. That was in part because I didn't want to get in any kind of fights with publishers. I didn't want it to become a transmission system for pirated content. And it's difficult, and we see this in Facebook, it's difficult for people to understand how to enable some amount of sharing of personalization of personal information without sharing everything to everyone. It's a very difficult problem to help people share with only the groups that they want, to communicate only to a subset of people they may have online contacts with, and to communicate effectively without essentially opening up that content to anyone. You know, we talk about projects, and there are some things in some of the commercial ecosystems where you can tweet about what page you're on or paste some amount of a line that you enjoyed. But every time there have been some steps forward to enable that, there's been pushback from authors and publishers and users who see reading as a private experience and see book purchases as intellectual property that has to be locked down at all costs. And so those steps forward have been fairly limited and generally within a particular ecosystem, which is different than the way that, say, Twitter works on when people discuss things they found on the web, where someone quotes it, they share a URL, everyone can go to that URL sort of together in a real-time conversation. That isn't how it works with ebooks right now, and it's hard to see how we will ever get to that point given the current set of players and the ways in which these book systems all work. It's not even possible to say, I'm reading this particular ebook and provide a link to that and have it be the same ebook that other people may be reading because I might have purchased it from Amazon or Kobo or just reading it on my iOS device. So we don't yet have that sort of common object that we can reference, and I think this is something that will come up in the Books and Browsers event too, that we are essentially taking the same content and replicating it in these different wrappers across a variety of retailers and devices, and to some extent that is bumping up against the natural desire people have when they're using the web to share and have an open conversation.
Well, but again, as you indicated, I think, you know, there may be multiple, it may be possible for there to be multiple ways for people to interact with content. There may be not, it may be possible for me to buy a book, let's say, as a private, and read it as a private experience, but then join a community or participate with the author's community, let's say, if that really does emerge, in those contexts, then I'm sharing. Whereas in other cases, I choose not to. You know, and I could do, you know, because it isn't necessarily true that we all behave the same way every time, even when we're, you know, involved in the same experience. So it is sort of interesting to imagine that kind of all of these things happening at the same time. Now, IBIS is HTML5, and I think this is something that people are beginning to hear about HTML5, but I'm guessing that a lot of people don't know what it is and what it can do. So maybe you could talk a little bit about HTML5 and what it means.
Sure. Unfortunately, that's a fairly big topic. HTML5 has...
In 5 minutes or less.
That's right. It's a technology that has kind of a real branding problem because it means many, many different things. And a lot of those are all relevant to publishing, but they're all essentially discrete and different concepts. Most of the time, if you hear about HTML5 in a general web context, well, just to back up, HTML5 is the next revision of the HTML standard that governs all of the markup and much of the behavior on the web. Now, traditionally, it has always been essentially a document format. It was a method to mark up and describe the document that would be posted on the web. That was its original intent. Over time, it's been augmented with other technologies to make it into the interactive experience that it is today, where you can fill out forms, you can click on things and have animation, where the web has become much more like any other piece of software that you run on a computer. And I think to probably many younger people, there is no difference between a program you run on a computer and something you interact with on the web. HTML5 is meant to advance that level of interactivity to make the web even more like an application, and we're starting to see its adoption in many web browsers, many of the newer ones, as well as on mobile devices. So most of the time when people currently are talking about HTML5, they're talking about pretty specifically the ability to have native audio and video rather than using plugins like Flash. And this has become fairly important because Flash is not available on the iPad and iPhone platforms, whereas HTML5 video is. So that's the normal time. Majority of the time people are discussing this, they're really just talking about video and audio and interactivity without Flash.
Go ahead. I had a question, but I think my question has to follow this.
Okay. One of the other interesting features about HTML5 is it also allows web pages to essentially leap off of the web and become installed as applications on a user's device or computer so that they're available even without an internet connection. And, of course, that is most compelling in a mobile context when you may be offline because you're in a subway or you've turned off wireless.
Or your internet goes down when you're home.
Or that's true, too. Or you're on an airplane, although that's increasingly less of
right.
an issue.
But there are plenty of times when we're not connected. So that is a very powerful add-on to HTML.
So that's the piece that IBIS is taking advantage of. IBIS is a web application, but it uses HTML5 to allow itself to be installed primarily on mobile devices. And in iOS in particular, you can install an HTML5 application, and it gets a little icon on the desktop and on the phone or the iPad, and it looks just like a native app. There are ways in which it doesn't behave exactly the same, but essentially it can do all of the kinds of things that a native app can do. So in an e-reader, IBIS is able to work like the Kindle app or Kobo by simply acquiring books, saving them to the user's phone, and then being available for reading even without an internet connection.
So here's the immediate question that I ask, thinking as a publisher here, or thinking as not necessarily a traditional publisher, but somebody with content who wants to, you know, anybody with content is essentially a publisher. So I say, I see IBIS Reader and I say to myself, does this mean that if I published an ebook, I would be able to distribute it myself to everyone who might have an IBIS Reader? In other words, does it enable me to go direct to consumer? Whereas in the, you know, if you look today at the ebook world, you know, you can be a publisher pretty readily, but let's say you are a community, you have a website, you're a pretty big, you have a pretty big audience. If I want to sell my audience an ebook, I have to say, oh, go, I'll publish it on Kindle, I'll publish it through Kobo, I'll publish it at Sony, I'll publish it with Nook, and I have to then send all of my my consumers, my community members, all the people that want to read my work, I have to send them elsewhere. And then not everybody has an ebook, not everybody has an e-reader, not everyone participates in that world. So the natural question is, does IBIS then offer me as a kind of self-publishing community the opportunity to reach my consumers directly?
It's a good question, and that's changing pretty fast. Right now, as I said, IBIS is kind of a transitional model like many of those others, in the sense that it is an application that acquires ebooks in the EPUB format and allows people to read them. What you're talking about is more like packaging the individual books as HTML5 applications in their own right that could be acquired by a user from anywhere and installed in quotes. The book can just download itself and live on a computer or a phone, and that's also a viable option, and that is closer to the model that the recently released project called Bookish by Joseph Pearson and Invention Arts. Bookish is HTML5, but instead of being a kind of repository for other books like IBIS, it itself creates HTML5 books that can be installed. So the experience, if you were a user on a phone, and if you got one of those books, instead of that book becoming a little item inside of IBIS or inside of your list of books in Kindle, it would become a little app on the desktop by itself. So it's much more like the sort of early books as apps that came out on the iOS platform before there were a mature set of e-readers. But the problem with books as apps was that they were very expensive to produce. Or if they weren't expensive, it's because there were companies that were just pouring content into them and sort of churning them out in a fairly generic way. I think creating books that are HTML5 apps themselves has a lot of compelling features. It is not as expensive to do because it's fairly open web technologies that any web developer can learn, but it allows you, the publisher, to have a tremendous amount of creativity and flexibility because you're not constrained by the requirements or limitations of the e-reader. You are kind of building the whole package, both the book and the experience. So that'll take a little while for, I think, some publishers to take advantage of, but I think we'll see some pretty cool experiments in interactivity and multimedia from publishers who get a pretty good technical staff but shouldn't need to make the kinds of tens of thousands of dollars investments that they do right now if they want to make a custom enhanced book app.
Right. I think that's I think that is actually a huge issue for publishers and for writers or anybody who's interested in content in this sort of taking content and making it more interesting in the digital space, because the cost is too high and there aren't enough people who will pay for it, or the cost of selling it becomes too high. So I think tools emerging that make production more rationally you know, in, more rational in terms of cost are going to be really, really important. So maybe you could talk a little bit also about what you see emerging as the standards and kind of the things that publishers should be thinking about in terms of where things are going. Or maybe writers too. You know, it's anybody who's interested in content. What's coming up next that they should really be thinking about?
So at 3Press, we're actively involved in the work to develop the next revision of the EPUB specification, and that version will be EPUB 3. And that work started at the beginning of this year. There's an in-person meeting next week in San Francisco to really dive into the actual hard technical details of how the spec is going to be written. But at this point, we have a good sense of what the shape of EPUB 3 is going to be. And a lot of the interesting stuff that will come out of it will be taken from HTML5 and similar next-generation web technologies. So we're going to be looking at a situation where there will be a common standard for publishers to produce multimedia content, which right now has been fairly challenging and expensive, and all the retailers have different requirements. The nice thing about a standard is that it will remove a lot of that confusion and overhead. We'll have some pretty common constraints on how you embed a movie or how you embed audio or how you can produce an audio track that can be synced to the text of the book, which is interesting both for accessibility reasons but also because people often like to switch between listening to a book and reading it. The other major angle in EPUB 3 is going to be allowing for books to have some amount of interactivity inside of them. So some pretty simple examples would be like an interactive textbook that has a quiz at the end of each section where when the reader selects which the answer they think is correct, it can actually tell them or keep score. That's a pretty basic type of interactivity, but one that is already in high demand. But I'm sort of interested to see what people will do in fiction or even nonfiction where interactivity becomes more about immersing the reader in the story or the world and not simply what we have right now, which is essentially just the ability to follow hyperlinks, but really the ability to either change the narrative or explore the narrative more deeply.
Right, or maybe go off on a tangent and, you know, say, I want to learn more about this character. So you can go down various peninsulas in the story that the writers created for you.
That's right. I mean, the possibilities are pretty infinite. But the challenge that we're facing as we try to write the specification is that kind of infinite flexibility really collides with this model of the e-reader as a framework in which content is poured. If the narrative is changing, if the text on the page is literally moving around before your eyes, what does that mean in the context of the e-readers we have today that are paginated? I don't think people want to see the sort of page changing out from under them, or what happens to the bookmarks that you've made if you've made a different decision about the story. There's all kinds of complexities that interactivity introduces and really grinds against this first wave of e-readers. So I think this idea of the e-book as a package of its binding in the way it appears, as well as the content, is going to become more important as interactivity increases, because there's the variability from book to book will simply be more than a Kindle-type app can accommodate.
Right, and of course that's true for any you know, any kind of structured system, the more flexibility you ask it to have, the more complex the programming, and in fact, more likely that things will not work the way they're supposed to work.
Right.
So here's one more question I wanted to ask you. It kind of naturally arises because of the little uproar earlier this week about when HarperCollins published the collected poems of Allen Ginsberg in digital form. In the EPUB, they managed to lose the line lengths for the poetry. And, of course, this is an issue that, you know, for anybody who is converting pages to digital files realizes that the idea of the page completely changes. How can EPUB and maybe EPUB 3, HTML 5, what do publishers need to do in order to be able to publish work that does require a certain amount of manipulation of data on the literal page as well as on the virtual page as well as the literal page?
Well, in the requirements phase for EPUB, there were some requests to include methods to do poetry formatting more intelligently, but I think that we've decided that's not a problem that can be really tackled at the standards level. You know, poetry is so infinitely complex. The way that we are going to increase the flexibility for formatting, I think, is fairly cool, and should see some rapid adoption, is we're going to borrow a technique from the web called, from the latest revision of CSS, the styling language, and it's called Media Query. And what it allows the content author to do is to supply a different set of layout for different screen dimensions. There's actually a lot in Media Query, but this is the most easy to understand. So you can say that if this content is being displayed on a phone, on a screen that is no more than 400 pixels wide, then apply these set of styles. If it's on a screen that's very large, maybe lay out this document in columns or show larger images, but maybe in a small screen you might want it to show crops. So instead of producing, as publishers do right now, a single style sheet for each ebook, they'll now have the opportunity to produce multiple ones if they choose, they don't have to that will be triggered in different contexts. So we may even, in EPUB, extend that to apply to, say, e-ink hardware readers that have a different set of characteristics than LCD screens. But initially, the main way that this will be used is to differentiate between mobile phones and tablets or full-size layouts on a computer.
Right.
Now, that won't totally solve all of the problems that poetry poses for reflowable content, but it will certainly allow for some richer and more intelligent presentations of you know, content that is more formatted than a straight text novel, but maybe less so than complex poetry.
Well, this is, you know, we could probably go on forever because I have so many questions to ask you, but I think I've reached the point where, you know, we have to close. I think it's been really interesting hearing what you have to say about this stuff. And I'm really, really glad you were able to give me some time. Thanks, Liza Daly, for talking to Publishing Talks. This has been David Wilk talking to Liza Daly. Thank you very much.
Thanks, David.